University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Eleanor McCoby, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University. McCoby's lecture is entitled Co-Parenting Before and After Divorce. In 1988, McCoby received the American Psychological Association's Award for Distinguished Scientific Contributions. An author and editor of six books dealing with psychology, McCoby specializes in socialization of children, development of sex differences, the effects of television on children's behavior, selective inattention in childhood and old age, and compensatory education. McCoby has taught at Stanford for 31 years and served as president of the Society for Research in Child Development for 2 years. Join us now for Dr. Eleanor McCoby and University Forum.
I'm wanting to talk to you this morning about divorce and its aftermath, and we will not be discussing this morning the reasons why the divorce rate is as high as it is or how it might be changed. The divorce rate, as some of you may know, has leveled off, but it remains high. I think what we need to try to understand this morning is what divorce means to family functioning and to the development of children. The early approach by researchers to studying divorce effects and trying to understand them was a fairly simplistic one. People would simply take a sample of people whose parents had been divorced and compare them with a group of people whose parents had not been divorced and see what the differences were. Then, of course, the somewhat more sophisticated things to do would be to try to set aside the effects of income and parental education and so on as possible reasons, other reasons why the two groups might diverge. It did emerge that it was really difficult to tell. If you were to go to a school playground, for example, you could look around you and identify children that you thought were behaving well and others who weren't behaving well. You would have a very difficult time just looking at children and their behavior, trying to identify which ones had divorced parents and which ones didn't. That simple comparison actually turned out not to tell very much. Now, it did turn out to be true that there was a higher rate of juvenile delinquency among the children of divorced families, broken homes, so-called. It also is the case that there are more school dropouts when you hold constant for socioeconomic factors among the children of divorced families. But the important fact remains that most children of divorce do not become delinquent. Most children of divorce do not drop out of school. The difference is... I'm sorry, are you having trouble hearing? No. The differences between divorced and non-divorced families are consistent and substantial in one sense and not substantial in another. For example, you will find on a national sample that about 22% of the children of divorced families drop out in high school, and 11% of the children whose families are not divorced. Now, that doesn't sound like a very big difference. If you think, however, of the fact that the risks of dropout are just about doubled if the parents are divorced, that makes it a more substantial and interesting fact. I think what's happened, we also find that the incidence of distressed emotional states, depression, anxiety, also premature early sexual activity among children, these things have higher rates among the children of divorced families, although once again, many, many children from divorced families are doing just fine. So people have begun to think of divorce not as a cause of distress in children all by itself, but as a risk factor, which combines with other factors in family life and in the children's lives to produce a variety of effects. We also see that since quite a few children are doing well despite their parents' divorce, there must be factors which will protect them from those risks. And enable them to cope successfully with the stresses of divorce. One of the things that we certainly have learned is that divorce is not a single event. It is a process. Of course, it's often preceded by marital discord, although quite a number of children, surprisingly, don't really realize that their parents' marriage is in any trouble Sometimes the break is quite a sudden one, as, for example, when one spouse learns that the other is having an affair outside the marriage and decides that's something they can't put up with, there will be a sudden crisis in the family and one parent leaves the household. And this is the first time the child has heard anything about difficulties. All children these days, however, are aware of the possibility. And I'm told widely by parents in intact families that when parents quarrel and the children hear it, the children say, "Are you going to get a divorce?" Now, of course, when a parent leaves the household, children suffer separation and anxieties and grief. They feel the loss. They feel abandonment. And perhaps more important, however, is that the situation that they remain in with the remaining parent has changed quite abruptly sometimes and quite profoundly. That is, the nature of the upbringing that they are receiving from in the household where they now are can be quite different than it was before. When psychologists have studied what parent-child interaction is like, it's possible to go to homes, large numbers of homes, and be a fly on the wall as much as possible, to just be an observer. Of course, when you first go to a household, people are not behaving in their normal way. They're remembering that they have a guest or a visitor and on their best behavior. But after you've been there several times, the observer tends to become ignored. And one then begins to see the enormous variety among families in the way they carry out their ordinary daily lives and the way parents and children interact with one another. If I were to ask all of you to write down a list of the things that you would look for if you were an observer that you would think would be important in the way families function in terms of how their children will turn out, we would have a list miles long, and they would not overlap an awful lot, although with respect to certain things, I think they might overlap. Psychologists in observing families have come up with two major dimensions. And when I speak of dimensions, what I'm referring to is the fact that although you can identify 1,000 different things about families, such as what forms of discipline do they use, do they withdraw privileges, tell children they can't watch their favorite TV set, ground them and not let them use their bike or whatever. Do they use physical punishment or not? Do they say to their children, "I don't want to look at that face of yours until it has a smile on it"? In other words, sort of a gentle withdrawal of affection for the moment to the child, or go to your room, you can't be here with us. You can imagine all the variety of things that parents might want to say to children. What one finds is that there are clusters of these things that go together in families, so that the families that express a lot of warmth and affection to their children, put their arms around the children, smile at them when they come in the room, those are the same families that use very little physical punishment, for example, on the whole, so that you can put these things together in clusters. And what we have found is that there seem to be two major dimensions of parenting which are fairly independent of each other. One has usually been called the warmth to rejection dimension. The other has been called control versus autonomy giving. I don't like those labels entirely. That is, it seems to me that a more accurate way to put how parents differ is to say that some set up standards and make demands on their children. This is the controlling end, where they have certain things that are rules or standards that the children are expected to conform to, and the parents see to it that the children do those things that are required of them, versus the families that have either don't set up the requirements very much. They think children are going to be okay pretty much with their own instincts, and you just don't demand an awful lot of the children. And some parents who, when they do have ideas about what they want the children to do, don't make them do it. Everybody, of course, in this room who has children, or all of those of you who have been a child, know that there are times when your parent tells you to clean up your room and you don't do it and you get away with it. Parents are not completely perfect with respect to the follow-through side. But high control on that dimension means not only having standards the children have to live up to, but making them accountable and seeing to it that they do it. Now, the other dimension, the warmth versus rejection dimension, has another side to it, I believe, and that is that the parent is responsive to the child's demands. That is to say, I regard parent-child interaction, when it's working well, as a reciprocal one, where parents not only are warm toward their child, but they convey the message, I am here for you. I am committed to your welfare. You have the right to ask me to help you and to be on your side, to give you the support that you need. And the reciprocal side of that is, and I have the right to make certain demands of you. So that the control dimension is the parent makes demands and enforces them side, and the warmth reciprocity side is, and I am the person that you can turn to for the fulfillment of your needs. In most families, then, on the control side of things, there are fairly well understood kinds of rules, and rules is kind of a strong word, and it doesn't quite describe what I mean, understood modes of behavior. You don't, for example, there are so many of these things that we have all learned in our early childhood, and we've forgotten the learning process or the fact that we were taught. We simply do them automatically. A used Kleenex you would never put down on someone else's dinner plate, for example. Why not? I mean, you don't remember being taught about cover your mouth when you cough and all the little things that have to do with hygiene. You were trained, and here you may remember some family hassles about this. After you've used the scissors or the hammer, put them back where they belong so that the next person who needs to use them can find them. The control of family joint resources that everybody needs to use takes some management. The knock before you rush into the bathroom, know whose possessions are whose and which you have the right to use and which you do not. Be careful when you walk around that you don't kick anyone else's shins or step on their feet or pull their hair. Not hurting other people physically, in other words, is one of the very first things that a child begins to learn in its first year of life, when mothers gently pull a hand away where the child tries to reach the glasses and pull the hair. And then, of course, as children get more mature, the division of household chores and who is expected to do what. Now, if you think about how this training takes place, I want to give you two little family vignettes that come from Diana Baumrind's work so that you can get a feel for what observers pick up when they go to a household. Here is what one observer saw. A boy gets up from the dinner table. This boy's about 5. Father says, "Hey, sit down." He is yelling, but good-naturedly. The boy sits down and finishes his milk, and then he gets up. "Father, what do you say, Todd?" "Boy, excuse me, please." "Father, what?" "Boy, excuse me, please." "Father, okay." Boy starts to leave the room, and on his way out, he says, "Tomorrow I'm not going to say it because I said it twice today." Okay, that's one little family vignette. Here's another one. Boy, to his mother, he's about the same age. "Can I go out?" Mother, "Yes." "Oh, no, I guess you can't. I didn't realize how late it was." Boy, "Please, mother," he begins to plead and whine. "I never get to go down the street." Mother, "Well, I'll tell you, honey, you can ride your bike on Fall Street." Boy, "No, on Spring Street." Mother, "Just once." Boy, "Why just once?" Mother, "You don't really want to go out." Boy leaves. Now, if you contrast those two situations and try to think of them in terms of our two dimensions, what about the first one with the father? Where would you place him on the control autonomy dimension? He's high on control, right? Can you place him on the warmth or reciprocity dimension? It's harder, isn't it? That piece of information that we have isn't a very good one for telling us whether he's responsive to what the boy wants done. You can only guess from the fact that this boy makes this crack as he leaves the room about, "I don't have to do this tomorrow," that he's accustomed to being able to bargain a little bit here and have his side of the picture presented to his father. The other one is one of very indecisive parenting. The mother doesn't seem to know exactly what she does want the child to do. She certainly doesn't follow through on whatever demand she has made. The child is able to get away with coercive behavior to keep her demands from being effective. What the warmth dimension is there, I don't think we know. Now, so we can place parents in a kind of a four-dimensional space, and the thing that has become clear is that the families that are functioning the best in terms of the outcomes for their children are the ones which are high on control and high on reciprocal warmth. That is, high on both dimensions. These are now called authoritative families. And these children are the ones who are doing the best. Surprisingly, they become independent and self-regulating and self-sufficient sooner than the kids who are given lots of autonomy, where the parents aren't exercising any rule managing or any control. So the high highs are good. The families where the children are in the worst trouble are the low lows, which we think of as disengaged or possibly uncommitted or even neglectful parenting, where the parents aren't making very many demands and they are also not responding, not being psychologically available to their children. Now, what happens, I think you can all realize that no parent stays in exactly the same place on these dimensions from day to day. Some work by Gerald Patterson at Oregon has involved making a daily hassle score. He calls up people in the evening and he says, tell me whether any of the following things have happened today. You got a bill that was higher than you expected that it was going to be. One of your pets was sick or injured. One of the family members was sick. Someone was seriously late for something, and so it made everybody late during the day for the next things that they had to do. A list of things that can happen in a family that make life harder. And what he discovered was that on those days when family hassles were high, now these are external pressures in a sense impacting upon the family, on those days the parenting skills dropped and the parents were less consistent, more punitive, more coercive, less willing to listen to what the children had to say, and so on. A very simple example of what stress does to parenting, and this is the mildest stress that you can imagine, came out of an experiment that one of our graduate students at Stanford did some years ago, where parents, either a mother or a father, brought two little children into our observation room. These are families that all had both a four-year-old and a two-year-old, and these two children were brought in to an experimental room, which I confess to you, we had booby-trapped so that there were a lot of opportunities for mischief in it. There was a tape recorder with a tape that the kids could pull out and mess up. There was, I hate to think of this now, a dirty ashtray. There was a tippable vase of flowers and no high shelf to put it out of reach and so on. Now, the experimental condition was that under one circumstance, the parents were simply there to help their children enjoy the toys that were playable and available and to keep them out of trouble. In the other condition, the parents were trying to work out an intellectual problem they had been given, a mental problem. They weren't using paper and pencil, so the children couldn't tell that they were preoccupied. But the parents had this thing in their minds that they were trying to do at the same time they were babysitting their children. And we were able to see that with the four-year-olds, they simply dropped down the level of their interaction with the children considerably. With the two-year-olds, they had to keep an eye on them, but they were more peremptory, more coercive. They gave less thought to the idea of how to occupy this child so it won't get into trouble. Now, these things give us a little premonition about what happens to parenting under the conditions of divorce, where what you have is parents suffering emotional distress from the loss of their spouse. That's probably the most gigantic factor of it all, depression and grief over this loss. Their loss of self-esteem because they feel that they've failed in one of the things that was most important to them. The financial burdens increase on both sides, both mothers and fathers, but primarily to the custodial parent. One parent has to do what both parents did before. And this can be pretty important because in intact families, parents do spell one another. And they look to see when the other parent is, their patience is getting stretched too thin. And they know this other parent is about to blow. And so they will step in and start to play with the children, take them out of the house, do something to give the other parent relief. So missing a spouse in that sense of a partner to rear the children with is extremely important. In current research, what we now believe, and the current work is no longer just a matter of comparing families that are divorced with families that aren't. What we do is to, first of all, consider divorce as a condition which leads to certain changes into the parent-child relationship. Let's see. And that leads to the child outcomes. And we now concentrate on this factor quite considerably and try to understand exactly what it is that's happening here. We think that, in fact, the direct effects of divorce on the children are rather minor by comparison with the effects that are mediated by what is happening in the family interaction. I'm so wired up here, I can't tell where I can walk. There. What we know so far, and this is largely work by Hetherington, is that parenting deteriorates considerably in the first year to year and a half after divorce, and that it tends to recover depending upon the life situation of the parent who is doing most of the child rearing. During that brief period after divorce, not so brief, at least a year and probably longer, mothers become less affectionate, less responsive. They don't chat so much with their children. They snap out orders instead of talking over what needs to be done. They fail to follow up on what they've demanded. The children react by being whiny, demanding, less compliant, and coercive cycles get started between mothers and the children, and particularly between mothers and sons. Now, however, there is big variation among families in the extent to which this deterioration happens. And there is some evidence that if children do continue to see their outside parent, most of the research has been done with mother custody because that's by far the largest category. It's harder to find the father custody cases. That you get less deterioration of maternal functioning if the father is still involved. Now, of course, we can't tell really whether it's just the mere fact that the fathers are involved with the children or the fact that there must have been less conflict between the two parents all along if the father can remain involved with the children. It's partly because of these findings on the effects of divorce on parenting and the effects of deteriorated parenting on children that people began to advocate joint custody for children. California is a state which has taken the lead in bringing in joint custody as a viable option through the statutes, the divorce statutes of the state. In 1980, we adopted a statute that gave a certain amount of priority to joint custody if the parents wanted it. And even if one parent did not want it, judges were authorized to award it if the other parent did want it. The idea behind joint custody is, first of all, that parents should continue to operate in their parental role after divorce. In other words, you may divorce your spouse, but you may not divorce your children. And the assumption was, too, that it's easier for whoever's doing the major parenting role to carry it out if they continue to get the support of the other. I think in the big enthusiasm for joint custody, one thing that might have been underplayed is the fact that in order to continue having the child see the other parent, a certain amount of cooperation is necessary, and between heavily embattled spouses, what may happen is that the child is going to be exposed to more conflict between the parents by very virtue of the fact that the outside parent continues to be involved. So now what we need to think about is if there is going to be, and there has been, a move to continue to try to keep both parents involved in children's lives after divorce instead of simply cutting all the ties, what is it like to try to parent a child jointly by two parents who are now divorced? It isn't simply a matter of each parent continuing to have the same relationship with the child that they had before the divorce. That can't be the only objective, even if those relationships were good. There are new things that enter into the parental scene after a divorce. For one thing, the two parents have to negotiate the division of the child's time. They have to negotiate over the logistics of getting the children back and forth from one household to another. And there are endless problems and difficulties, as you might imagine, when a parent who was supposed to pick up the child at 5 o'clock for the weekend calls up at the last minute and says, sorry, I can't make it. And the parent who is the one that the child has been with has made plans and has to have those interrupted, has to cancel them. There are all kinds of opportunities for letting each other down and creating anger. Furthermore, when the outside parent comes to pick up the child, sometimes other issues are raised when the two find themselves face to face about why has your child support payment not arrived this month and things of that kind. There are issues to be resolved about which parent is supposed to pay for what, issues about who is supposed to consult about what issues, which parent has the right to make certain decisions about whether the child's going to have a major piece of medical care or whether the child is going to change schools, who is going to be the one that goes to talk to the teacher when a note comes home from the teacher, and so on. And in particular, the coordination, enough information going back and forth so that each parent will be aware of the issues that are involved in the child's current welfare. I can give you an example of the kind of issue that can arise. There is the case of a little girl, age 3 and a half, who was in joint custody and spent every other week with her mother, every other week with her father. She got an ear infection while she was with her mother. The mother's pediatrician prescribed antibiotics, and the child was partway through the course of taking this medicine when she was shifted to her dad's house. The usual scene in that household was for the mother to drive up in front of the father's house, open her car door, let this little girl trot up the sidewalk, ring the father's doorbell. Mother would wait and make sure he was home to receive the child, and then she would drive away. On this occasion, she got out and followed the child up the front walk and tried to hand the bottle of medicine to her former husband and explain to him what was going on. He pointedly ignored her. These two parents were not speaking, and ushered the little girl in and closed the door. So the mother put the medicine down on the front step and hoped that he had heard enough or that he would find out that it was there. When the little girl came back the next week, the mother questioned her about the medicine. The little girl, of course, being 3 and a half, was not a very good reporter about all of this, but she did say that her dad had taken her to his doctor. Now, the two pediatricians didn't know each other, didn't share a common medical record. I think you can see the slippage that's possible here in the care of children for parents who are trying to both be involved in the child's life, but who are not communicating with one another. One of the important functions that happens in families where the parents are together is that parents can actually function to shield a child from excessive behavior. Now, this, of course, happens in only a minority of families, but there are families where one parent can become violently enraged or seriously drunk or under the influence of drugs. At moments like that, having another parent present who can deal with the child, protect the child, take the child out of reach of a parent who is at that moment endangering, or a parent, let's say, who cannot control his or her sexual impulses, having another parent who is functioning well and can protect the child is of greatest importance. When the two parents are in separate households, these buffering functions by the parents are very difficult indeed to exercise. All right, at this moment then, I simply want to turn to tell you a little bit about the kinds of work that we have been doing with approximately 1,000 families in California near the San Francisco Bay Area who divorced in the year 1984-85. We interviewed the parents over a span of 3 years. In this last year, the fourth year following the divorce, we have been interviewing the children of those families, that is to say, all those children who were aged 11 through 18. So young adolescents and older adolescents are the subjects of our follow-up study. Our focus has been twofold. We have been wanting to know, first of all, about the custodial arrangements and how these impact upon the parenting processes and the co-parenting relationship that emerges after divorce. Parenting and co-parenting. And then we have wanted to know how these things affect the information we've been able to get from our adolescents. And we're just in the process of doing the analysis of the adolescent data now, so I can only give you a few little tidbits about how this is all turning out. Having a sample of the size that we do have, which isn't large enough, but it's larger than most people have had, that has enabled us to have a group of father custody families and a group of joint custody families. Our families distribute themselves. About two-thirds of the families have mother custody. 18% have joint or dual residence. And about 10% have father residence. There's a small residual group where the children are not with either parent, or where they have one child with one parent, another child with another. Split. So I'm going to be talking about the comparison between mother residence, dual residence, and father residence. Now, let me be clear that that may not be exactly the same thing as was written down on the divorce decree. As joint custody, joint physical custody, may be decreed in the divorce decree, but that doesn't necessarily mean that 3 years later you're going to find the child still going back and forth between the two households. And as a matter of fact, what we do find is that the most stable arrangement is being in mother custody. If the children start out living with mother, they've got more than an 80% chance that they will still be with her 3 years later. If they started out in dual residence, there's only a 50-50 chance that they will still be in a dual arrangement 3 years later. Fathers are in between. For the children who actually are spending substantial time in both households. Now, here I mean not just living in both households, but, say, living with mother and visiting father on a regular basis, at least two overnights every two-week period, every other weekend, in other words, spending with dad, regular visitation. For those families, we examined how they were handling the co-parental process. And what we found is that people have solved their co-parental arrangement in one of three ways, basically. One we call the conflicted families, and these are the families where, although the kids are still going back and forth, the parents can't cooperate on rulemaking. They don't have agreed upon routines for the children in both households. So in one household, they're allowed to watch R-rated movies on TV, and the other household, they are not. In one household, they have one bedtime. In another household, they have another. So lack of coordination of rules. The parents in those highly conflicted families are undermining one another. And it's really hard to describe to you the enormous variety that undermining can take. I think yesterday I was describing to somebody one of our families where the boy who was living with the father, there had been a custody dispute. The mother wanted the children. The father had them. The boy reached 16 and got his driver's license and was driving his dad's car on occasion. He committed some infraction, and I don't know what it was, but the father grounded him and said, "You may not drive the car for the next 2 months." So the boy called the father and the mother and complained about this. And she said, "Oh, honey, he's being too hard on you. I wouldn't have grounded you for that. If you were over here, you could drive my car anytime you wanted to." So what do you suppose the boy did? Moved in with mother. The kids discover ways and means that they can play off conflicted parents against one another, and they become very skillful at it. Teenage boy of 14 says to his dad on a weekend when he's visiting his dad that he's promised mother he would go home and feed the dog. Now, he hadn't promised mother that. Mother had made other arrangements for that. Mother was out of town, but the boy went over to his mother's house, called up his friends, and they had a beer party at his mother's house. Ways and means of getting out from under the surveillance of two parents. Now, this is in the conflicted households, where they also have a lot of difficulty managing the back and forth of the younger children. Who is going to drive? Whose turn is it? How can I be sure that you will bring the children back on time, or that you will be here on time to pick them up, etc.? Another pattern is the cooperative pattern. And here the parents do make an effort to stay in touch with each other and talk about rules and regs. One example would be a father who called up his ex-wife and said, "Is she allowed to wear lipstick to school?" And the mother said, "Not till she's in junior high." So he said, okay, and told his daughter that, who is a sixth grader then and hadn't got into junior high, no. Although she had been saying to her dad, Mom says it's all right. Which, of course, he was able to check on because he had a cooperative relationship with his wife. And the cooperative people have an agreement with each other that they will not downplay the other person. They will not make scurrilous remarks about the other parent. When the child complains, Mom said I had to do so-and-so, and you don't make me do that. And the father in a cooperative pair will say, when you're at her house, you do what she says. She's in charge. As distinct from, you're right, I wouldn't make you do that. It's too bad you have to be over there, and she is such a mean person, which is what the conflicted parents would do. The third pattern that we find is that even though the children are going back and forth, the parents are completely disengaged. They don't fight, but they also don't cooperate. Here you will find families where the children are picked up and dropped off at a neutral place, for example, at the babysitter's or at school. When that happens, any messages that have to be taken are imposed upon the caregiver or the school teacher. I don't know if any of you are school teachers to whom this has happened, but the parent brings the child to school and says, would you mind telling my ex-wife that this child is supposed to be taking antibiotics for the rest of the week, something like that. It puts an undue burden on people to carry out family functions who aren't part of the family. Either that, or the child is relied upon to carry messages, such as, please tell your father if his support check doesn't arrive this week, he's not going to see you next week. Now, the child tries to convey that message to the father, who says, what? Have I ever told you how much money I've given to that woman? And so on. And the child feels completely in the middle. So disengaged families place burdens upon their children, but probably not as great as the families who are in a conflicted situation. Now, the family process in each of the two households is something else that we have been studying. And what we find is that, in general, in families where it's either a father custodian or it's a dual residence situation, when the children are with dad, either if he's the primary caretaker or a member of a dual residence couple, he has more trouble monitoring the children's activities, whereabouts, keeping track of their interests, and so on, than mothers have. And this has nothing to do with the custodial arrangement. It stands up pretty clearly as a difference between the skills that mothers and fathers have. Mothers usually have a longer history of close interaction with the children where they know things like their physical rhythms. They can tell when the child is getting a cold. They know what the child's favorite breakfast cereal is. They are more sensitive to moods. They remember the history of certain things so that they know when the child had shots and that kind of thing. They tend to know the names of their children's friends. They will bring the friends into the household and find out how the kids are getting along. They're sensitive to a difficulty the child is having at school or with peers to a somewhat greater extent than fathers are, who have not been historically involved in those kinds of interactions and whose history of interaction style doesn't lend itself quite as well to that. Mothers, on the other hand, have more trouble remaining firm and patient. They have more trouble enforcing discipline, they tell us. They have more trouble being consistent. They have more trouble hanging on to their cool when the children are difficult to deal with. And I'm not sure why this is the case. We do know that in intact families, for some reason, children obey their fathers more readily than they do their mothers. And I think that one of the things that's happening here is that mothers do need the backup of the fathers in intact households, where the father suddenly emerges from the living room where the child didn't know he was hearing, and the father says, young man, I don't want to hear you talking to your mother like that. These kinds of coalition things between the mother and father help both persons' authority very much. One of the things that happens in the process of divorce is that the parental coalition gets broken. And what you have is children who formerly saw their parents as a kind of unit together, who were in agreement about what was supposed to be demanded of them, and who demonstrated that each parent was worthy of the affection and respect of everyone in the family. When these kids have overheard quarrels, have seen somebody leave the house, and have had their mother say to them, honey, I don't love your father anymore, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't. I mean, it's all right for you to think of him as very lovable, even though I don't. Well, children find it hard to believe that their father is as lovable as they thought when they thought their mother loved him. And so the breaking of the parental coalition is one of the things that happens. And I think we certainly know in cases of spousal abuse, when husbands have beaten wives, that young boys in particular turn on their mothers and show aggression toward them. And I think that this difficulty that mothers are having maintaining discipline and maintaining their patience may reflect something of the fact that their position as a respected and loved authority has been weakened by the whole divorce process and the departure of the spouse. Well, what have we found about the effects of custodial arrangements on parenting and the effects of parenting on child outcomes? Very briefly, what we have found is this. Custodial arrangements don't make much difference in the outcomes for the children. There is a slight tendency in our data for the children living with their dads to be doing less well than the children who are living in either dual residence or mother residence. We think that may be because the children who are most difficult are ending up in their father's households a little more often. The dual families and the single mother custody families are doing quite well. The ones where the children are not doing well are the families where the parents have had a conflicted co-parenting relationship. If parents have joint custody and cooperate well, there is now reason for us, we think, that that can be the best of both worlds for children because they maintain two parents as resources for themselves now and in the future. If, however, the two parents in a joint arrangement are conflicted, the child is in the middle, has loyalty conflicts, becomes guarded, doesn't know what it's okay to say to each parent, keeps secrets from parents, and begins to distance himself or herself from the parents, disengages from the family prematurely, relies too much on peers. So our current view is it doesn't matter an awful lot who gets custody. What matters is who accepts what responsibility for certain child-rearing functions and how well they can work together in the best interests of the child. What we need now is to work with divorcing families to make them understand that parenting is forever and that to some extent they have to work together in bringing about the child's best interests. Thank you.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Dr. Eleanor McCobe. Her lecture was entitled Co-Parenting Before and After Divorce. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts university located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 programs at the university.